Okay, open to Romans 8:5. Kind of what you get this morning is a message in progress. That this series that we're doing, Following Jesus, and today, Lessons from the Shepherd, I will acknowledge to you that I've struggled with this. And I know there's a lot here, and I'm having trouble getting very far ahead to get some real direction on what the next step is. So really where you're kind of getting this morning, exactly where I am. I'm not very far ahead of you, and I'm not ahead of you at all. So it's, I guess you get to be a part of the studying process this morning, as I don't, there's definitely not a wrapped up package for you. But what we're trying to do here is trying to learn how Jesus prepared the disciples, the 12 disciples who were appointed apostles, special representatives of Jesus, how he prepared them to take over what his cause and purpose was in this world. That this short, less than 3 years, this short amount of time to take these guys. And we've talked about who they are, and every single one of them, they were not in the sense of being scholarly or being prepared in any way. They were not above us in the least. And so what we're trying to do is see how Jesus interacted with them, see what he taught them, and see how he prepared them for the next step. So that's where we're headed. And one of the primary things that that we came up with that needed to happen in these guys' lives, and this is something, there was immaturity there, but this is something that happened fairly quickly with them. With all of their difficulties, with all of their failings and shortcomings, this thing happened pretty quickly. And I'm having trouble getting away from this, because if this doesn't happen, then we're just not going to get very far. We're just adding on stuff. Knowledge, maybe, or just good habits. But if we don't get this part, if we don't get what the disciples got at an early stage, then I believe we're really missing. We're really missing something. And we will try to do things that we're never going to be able to do until we get this part. And we looked at 1 Samuel. We won't go there now. That's about, some of you probably already turned there, that God has a plan for your life. But it's God's plan for your life. He has a plan to prosper you. He has a plan for you to have purpose and meaning in your life and to have direction. But the big struggle is, it's God's plan. In Romans 8:5, particularly the second part of that verse, but I'll read the first part just to set it up. Those who live according to the sinful nature, really there's only two choices that he gives us here in this verse. Those that live according to the sinful nature have their minds set on what that nature desires. Have their minds set on their own desires, whether that's fulfilling the lust of the flesh or the goals and ambitions or pleasures, or whatever it might be. Mind set on what the old nature, the flesh, desires. But those who live in accordance with the Spirit have their mind set on what the Spirit desires. And what has happened with these guys and what we've been looking at is that they've had a core purpose change. I tell you, I think you can be in the ministry. I think you can be a missionary. I think you can be in church all your life. I think you can go to Bible studies 3 times a week. And this never happened. That you're at your core, when you get up and start through your day, that your purposes are about the purposes of Jesus. That you, as we already looked at, that you eat His flesh and drink His blood. That you take on at your core and your purpose for everything you do is the core, is the same purposes of Jesus. There's a, and what happens when you move in that arena, when you go in that direction, is you get to this place of extreme reliance on God. Because the purposes and the core of Jesus, those things you cannot do. Those things you are not capable of. And you'll find yourself in a place of extreme reliance. And one thing is, when you take on His purpose in your core, you'll find yourself going out on a limb. You'll find yourself taking on things that you can't do. And then the minute you quit trusting, you just crash. I know this feeling. It seems like I have things that I cannot do, and I've taken these things on, and then one day I don't trust, and I just seem to just crash. There's a quote from William Carey, who took on a tremendous job of evangelizing India. And this quote, "Expect great things from God, attempt great things for God." And I would add to this, keep expecting and keep attempting, even in the midst of failure, of what appears to be failure. Now, the job of the body is to equip, prepare, and train you to do that very thing, to take on the purposes of God, to labor for the kingdom. And one description of this is in Matthew 11:28. We've looked at this, but I keep having to go back to some of these basic things we've been covering. I haven't been able to leave them yet. So let's go to Matthew 11:28. And I hope from some verses we've already read, we won't go back to those, that I have proven to you, hopefully through the Word, that God has a purpose for you, a plan for you individually. God has a plan for your life. He has things for you to do, not just specific things to do. He has a whole direction for you to take, a purpose for your life. He has that. Now, I'm not saying that He's ever going to roll out the map and just hand it to you and say this is from start to finish. It's a daily trust thing, but He does have a plan for your life. So hopefully we've already proven that. And let's look at this, Matthew 11:28. "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened." Did anybody show up this morning weary and burdened? "And I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me, for I am gentle and humble in heart, and you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy and my burden is light." Quit working for yourselves and work for Jesus. That's what your life is to be about. It's to quit working for yourself. No matter if we have to go and show up for our jobs, but the core for doing your job is quit working for yourself and start working for Jesus. And when you really do that, there's a surrender factor in taking on the yoke of Christ. The picture there is the oxen. There's a yoke, a double yoke on the oxen, and that you're getting in the other side with Jesus. That He's in the place of the oxen and you're the little skinny donkey, you know. But He's doing the work. But He wants us in the yoke with Him. And there's a surrender factor to get there, to accept His purpose and His course rather than our own. But when we do, there is a rest involved in it. And we looked at this thing of when you set out for your week and you have your to-do list, what motivates that to-do list? What's at the core of it? These things that you want to accomplish so you feel like you've done something and you feel better? Or is at the core of it the purposes of God? So, you may be getting your finances in order. You may be learning and how to have family devotions or a million different things in your own home. But those things are to be a step to fulfill God's purpose, not just so you can be more of this or more of that. And as I said, the body is to one of the central purposes of us together is to equip us. To equip us for living? Well, yes, to equip us for living. But it's so much more than that, that the body is to go more, to take it to another level, another step. And that is to equip us for ministry. And you can look at that if you want as you, in Ephesians 4:11, we won't go there, But that's where the idea is taken from, that we are being equipped not just to live a better life, not to just have joy and peace and those things. Yes, we are to have those things. But we are to be equipped for ministry. And we talked about that last week, that you are called to the ministry every bit as much as I'm called to the ministry. Now, I'm called, and other leaders in the church are called, to help equip you. And we're called to equip each other, but really, you guys are the ministers. In technical terms, you guys are the ministers, and I'm more in a role of equipping and, you know, helping out. Getting moving. So, Jesus chose 12 men to carry on His purposes. These 12 guys were going to train the church to do what we were just talking about. So, we want to look and see how did He prepare them for that step of when He left, when the Holy Spirit came, and they were to carry on with the work of Jesus, because Jesus was not physically going to be there. And it just, you know, it's just like God to do what He did. He chose 12 of the most ordinary, even you could say obstinate, common, selfishly ambitious. It's like, I don't know why He chose those guys, except to show us an example that God can use me, and He can use you. Whatever you think your restrictive circumstances, or education, or personality, or whatever, God intends to use you. And we could have a list of verses there that talk about how God uses the common and the ordinary. We won't go to all those. We've already read those. So, this time I saw some of you last time were jotting down some of the names. I went ahead and made a list there for these guys, just so the names are familiar to you. That you have them in your mind, that you place a name, at least, with the people that these guys that are going to be with Jesus, that He is going to be training. So if you, the first ones were probably called there in John 1, 35 to 42, and we'll read those verses a little later. But like I said, if you want to look at those while we're talking about this, that would be good. Now, the first ones called, all four of them were fishermen. Now, some of the rest we're not sure of all their occupations, but they were working class, rough, uneducated fishermen. The inner circle, that's the ones that seemed to, you know, even Jesus in His earthly ministry, He was somewhat limited by a physical body and being in time and space, that He had some guys, He was closer to than others, and that's just the way it was. He had this inner circle of four, and really an inner circle of three. There was Peter, and this is Simon Peter. There are at least seven other Simons in the Gospels, so every time you see Simon, it doesn't mean Simon Peter. You have to pay attention. And there's James and John. James and John are brothers. And then there's Andrew. All fishermen, all from Galilee, all live near the water, and all four of them probably knew each other. Same occupation, were probably friends. So, Peter and Andrew, brothers, and James and John, sons of thunder they're called, brothers. Now, Andrew was in the first group, but we don't hear that much about Andrew. Andrew was kind of in the shadow of his dominant brother, Peter. But every time we hear about Andrew, it's something positive. And it usually has to do with bringing somebody to Jesus. He's the one that brought Peter to Jesus. When he was told that there's Jesus, he went without any consideration that he may get kind of bumped to the side, which in a sense happened. He went and he brought his brother Peter to meet Jesus. And then there were two Greeks in John chapter 12 that they came to Philip and they wanted to see Jesus. And Philip brought them to Andrew. Andrew was just the guy that was always He's just in the background. He's just bringing one by one. He's just bringing people to meet Jesus. And when the huge crowd sat down and Jesus was going to feed all of them, and he said, basically gave them the responsibility to feed them, and everybody else was looking at the whole big mass and saying, what are we going to do? We can't handle this. What are we going to do? We can't. What are you talking about? Feed all these people. And there's Andrew quietly going about his business, looking over the crowd. He spots a little boy, has just a few fish and just his lunch with him. And he grabs that boy and he brings him to Jesus. He says, look, Jesus, here's this little boy. He has a lunch. And Jesus commended him both for his faith and just that thing of just not just looking at the masses, but just caring about an individual and seeing what could be done just by reaching out to an individual person. And this is how most people come to Christ, isn't it? This is how most people come. Through their friends, their co-workers, their family. And how are we going to see fruit as a body? It's going to take a lot of Andrews. It's going to take us showing people Jesus. Bringing people to Jesus. And we'll talk about that a little bit more later. That was a little bit of a bunny trail in the midst of our list. That was the top four. The four guys that were closest to Jesus. Then there's Philip and Bartholomew, also known as Nathanael. You remember Nathanael was quick to have faith. But also grouped with him was Thomas, who was a skeptic, who always needed proof. Then you have Matthew, the tax collector. James, the son of Alphaeus. Thaddeus, the disciple with three names. Lebbaeus and Judas, because he's also known as. And then there's Simon the Zealot, who was, we talked about him last week, somewhat, you could say, had a little bit of a terrorist mindset. And then Judas Iscariot, the traitor. And all extremely different personalities, and all at times slow to obey, yet these are the men that Jesus was preparing. He was going to train these 12 guys to take over where he left off, and these 12 guys were going to turn the world upside down. He left it with these 12, as we talked about last week, sometimes boneheads. These guys that were stubborn, and they wouldn't listen, and they were uneducated, yet they took on the purposes of Jesus and relied on him. And these are the men that he used. Now, don't think that he waited until they were absolutely ready before he used them. Because he sent them along with others, there were 70 in all, that he sent out to basically preach the same message that John the Baptist was preaching. He didn't wait till they were fully ready before he put them to work. He many times put them to work during their training. Now, it's important, as we look at their training, to see the absoluteness of their call. And the verse that we read last week, and Carlton read it this morning, gives us an indication of the completeness that he desires of those who would follow him. This is what he wants of those that would follow him. And it's Luke 14:26. If anyone comes to me and does not hate his father and mother, his wife and children, his brothers and sisters, yes, even his own life, he cannot be my disciple. This is the level of love for Jesus that dominated their life. That their love for their family was as if it was hate when compared to the love for God. He was calling them to this kind of love, this kind of this level of commitment. And you know, you have to ask yourself, if you're on the road to being a disciple, is this part of your Christian experience? Is this the kind of love that you have for Jesus? Now, if you say, well, I can't just manufacture that love, well, in one sense you can. Because if you have the Holy Spirit living in you, then you can choose to love, and you can commit those things. When you choose and you commit, remember the love principle. You remember what Jesus has done for you. Remember the love that God has for you. Then you choose to love Him, and then you commit your life and your purpose to Him. And the result of that will be your love for Him will be so great that your love for your family and those close to you will seem like hate compared to your love for Jesus. That's the kind of love we are to experience. We are really actually to experience that kind of love for God in our walk with Him. It's to be part of it. That's the absoluteness of our call. And when you remember, when the call was given and the hard messages were heard, they did not turn away. This is what I admire them for. They did not turn away when they heard the hard message. In John 6:48 through 69, we won't read all those again, but at the heart of that, it is where Jesus said to them, said to the crowds, if you do not eat my flesh and drink my blood, then basically you have no part of me. In other words, if you don't radically take on my purpose, take on my calls, eat, think, play, work, Jesus, then you have no part of me. And the crowds left. Then he looked to his disciples and he said, you guys going to go too? And they stayed. They stayed. They saw. There was nowhere else for them to turn. There was nowhere else for them to go but to follow Jesus. And the effectiveness of the disciples was not just that they spoke truth out of knowledge, because they spoke a lot of truth. When you look at the early days of the church, they had to teach and instruct. And they were doing that. But it came out of the yoke. If they were not in the yoke with Jesus, having taken on His purpose already, heard the hard sayings of Jesus and not turned away, had a love for Him that dominated their life, that's why they were heard. They had a life that was all about Jesus, and they taught out of their intimacy with Jesus. And that's what made them heard. That's what made them powerful. So, you can say, and you should ask, then what is this asking of me? What is this way of thinking, this line of thinking, talking about Jesus training His disciples and calling us? What is He asking of me? You are, I'll tell you, you are to be a minister inside and outside of the church. You and your home are to be a ministry center. Center. C-E-N-T-E-R. Not just have mental acceptance of this fact. Not just have a mental acceptance of taking on the purpose of God. It's, I must be a disciple. And that proverb we looked at last week, as a mirror reflects a man's face, what you do reflects your heart. That's what reflects if you are actually responding. It's not just if you have an intellectual agreement, but are you living the purposes of Christ? We are called to be ambassadors from 2 Corinthians 5:20, representatives of Jesus. We're called to be ministers in Ephesians 4. And in Galatians 2:20, it's not us that live, but it's Jesus that lives His life in us. And in Matthew 28:19, He sends us out to go and make disciples. So these guys have been stubborn, and they are very ordinary, and they don't have any kind of special education. But they did the main thing. They did the main thing. They ate and drank Jesus. They took on His purpose. At their core, their being, and their intimacy with Christ was their strength. Their intimacy with Christ was their strength. Not who they were or who they used to be. So, what are these guys, what are their lessons that Jesus is giving to prepare them? These apostles, there on part D on your outline, lessons from the shepherd. These apostles received the foundation of the church, like, in a sense, like the skeleton of information, and the flesh was to be added later. And you see that happening in the New Testament. You see more information being added through the apostles later. But they already had the basics that were given by Jesus, and that's really where we're going to stay. The Holy Spirit taught them later and completed the story in the New Testament. He gave them, but still in the Gospels, He gave them a tremendous amount of teaching and life lessons. And if you open to Acts 2:42, it gives us just a little picture, because this is right at the beginning of the church, and we've looked at this verse in depth in the past. But it gives you a little bit of a, this is the result of the training that they already had by Jesus. They've already been trained. There's no time here for them to be trained and equipped. They have already had to be ready, and this is their response. This is what they were doing in the church. This is kind of a result of their training. And remember, the apostles are not just the ones that we know about or we read their sermons. The apostles were all, their teaching was in agreement with one another. So you may have Thomas or Philip or Nathaniel. These guys are active in the church just because we don't read that much about them. They were apostles. They were doing miracles and wonders, and they were teaching and they were training the church. And all of these guys that have been trained by Jesus were in agreement with their teaching and what was going on. So this is talking about, this is what happened, the result. They devoted themselves, this is talking about the whole church, not just these guys. They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and to fellowship and to breaking of bread and to prayer. And we also, as we have studied this, we also know that they were devoted to evangelism, sharing of the gospel, and they were devoted to intimacy with Christ. And those were the things that, those were the core things of the church, because those were the core things that Jesus had trained them in and prepared them for. Jesus trained the 12, and the 12 trained the church. That was how it worked. The church here, though, it has just been born. And they, these apostles, were representatives, and the church would soon be representatives of Christ and the future bride of Christ. But the pattern was set. The pattern of training was set by Jesus. So how did Jesus train them? How did He equip them and prepare them for what they were going to do? And last week I read this quote from last week from John MacArthur. His example was always before them. They could listen to His teaching, ask questions, watch how He dealt with people, and enjoy intimate fellowship with Him in every kind of setting. He gave them ministry opportunities, instructing them and sending them out on special assignments. He graciously encouraged them, lovingly corrected them, and patiently instructed them. This is how the best learning always occurs. It isn't just information that is passed along. It's one life invested in another. Here again, the effectiveness of these disciples was not just what they knew, but that the investment that Jesus had made in them and their intimacy with Christ. And He's training them to do what they actually ended up doing. It was a struggle all the way along the way, and we see their failings. But there in Acts 2:42, that's what they were trained to do. They did what they were trained to do. And we see it throughout the rest of the New Testament. They did not remain the same. It becomes obvious when you track their lives. They grew in humility, in love, in restraint, in boldness, in sacrifice, in faith. They did not remain the same. Now, Jesus' plan for these disciples, His plan for the church, His plan for His message to stay and grow in this world, centered around the risky endeavor of investing in people. That's what you see. Jesus investing in those 12 guys. And it is risky. It's risky because you risk losing time. You risk failing that you invest and nothing comes of it. Judas. You risk losing finances. You risk becoming cynical. Because when you're dealing with people, they don't always respond how you want them to respond. And to become cynical is not, most people don't want to go there, so they avoid it. The temptation to become cynical. So when we invest in people, it is a risk of time, finances, risk of failure, risk of becoming cynical, a risk of fatigue, a risk of not doing the things that we want to do. But the early church is proof that these guys took that risk and they invested in others. Now, this is not to negate the power inherent in the gospel. There is a power inherent in the gospel to change lives. And we talked about that. When you drop the gospel into a situation, it has the power to change things. And it does change things. But there is to be an ongoing investment. Let's look at kind of the, just briefly here, you could say phase one of discipleship. Phase one of discipleship. And this is only recorded in John. The other three Gospels do not record this, this flavor. It's, you know, we discussed earlier that Jesus didn't avoid giving a huge challenge to virtual newcomers to forsake all and follow Him. He would tell people, brand new people, you know, about dying to self, about forsake all and follow me, leave it all behind and follow me, give up everything and follow me. But you see this, there's this little bit of a, John gives us this little picture here of when these first four disciples were called, it's like they had this little introductory thing here. And I just thought it was interesting. John 1:39. Well, let's go up to 37. 39 is the main verse there. When the two disciples heard him say this, they followed Jesus. Turning around, Jesus saw them following and asked, "What do you want?" They said, "Rabbi," which means teacher, "where are you staying?" "Come," he replied, "and you will see." They went and saw where he was staying and spent that day with him. It was about the 10th hour. Then if you skip down to verse 46, Nathanael is kind of commenting here, but Philip gives him the same thing basically that Jesus said. "Can anything good come from there, from Nazareth?" Nathanael asked. "Come and see," said Philip. And what you see here is Jesus telling them basically, just come and see me. Just come see what I'm about. There's no arm twisting, no manipulating, but they were to come, and they already had been set up for this by John the Baptist. They came, and they were, and they should have been, expecting the supernatural. Something more than discipline and family values and emotional experiences. They came expecting to see the power and life of Jesus. And in a sense, we too are called to do this same thing. To tell others in a simple way, come and see. Come and see. Come and see my life. It gets risky right there. Because it's sacrificial to ask someone to come and see your life. Because that requires time. That requires risk of investing your life in another person. But really, the message is, come and see Jesus. Come and see Jesus in me. The power and life of Jesus seen. And Jesus took the risk of investing His life in these men. He didn't invite them to seminary. He didn't invite them to Bible school. He wasn't even inviting them to the synagogue. He just invited them to come and see His life. And He spent the day with them. He doesn't tell us what He did. They were just coming to see Jesus. The life and the power of Jesus. It was something supernatural. And when we invite someone to come and see, they should see something supernatural. They should see us trusting God. They should see us with peace and joy and living for Christ. Having our purposes be the same as Christ. That's supernatural in itself. When you have taken on the core purposes of Christ and you invite someone else to see and you invest your life in theirs, as Jesus did and as these disciples learned how to do. Come and see. That was just the most basic invitation. Come and see. Was it complex? Wasn't full of theology. It was just, come and see. Come and see Jesus. Come and see Jesus in me. We'll close with that.